Hello everyone, my name is Nashil Tash. I am the Professor of International Politics and Director of Security Studies at SETA Foundation in Ankara, Turkey. Welcome to our new book talk series. In this series, we invite scholars from different fields, mainly international security studies. Our aim is to introduce newly published books about international security, terrorism, and contemporary defense studies and help to understand the changing nature of international and regional security. Today, we have a distinguished speaker, Dr. Ömer Aşur. He has an excellent academic background and great think tank experience. I would like to talk about his biography. Dr. Aşur is an associate professor of Security and Military Studies and the founding chair of the Critical Security Studies program at Doha Institute for Graduate Studies. He is the author of How ISIS Fights. This is what we are going to speak today. Military Tactics in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Egypt, and the Radicalization of Jihadist Transforming Armed Islamist Movements, as well as the editor of Bullets to Ballots, Collective Deradicalization of Armed Movements, which will be published by Edinburgh University in 2021, August. Ömer, welcome.
Thank you very much, Murat. Always a pleasure to be with you guys, and congratulations on the new platforms, new achievements. SETA is always leading the field in the region on issues of security and military and strategic studies.
Thank you, Ömer. First of all, of course, congratulations for your new book. It's common to speak about the rise and fall of ISIS. There are, of course, many drivers behind its rise and many factors behind its failure. Many studies have been focused on different dynamics of ISIS, including its governance model, ideology, such structure, and so on, but not too much study focused on ISIS warfare tactics. You especially focus on this important dimension of ISIS by taking into consideration four important cases: Libya, Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. I would like to raise the first question. Could you explain the main argument of book and how it will contribute to the current literature on ISIS? Why this book is an important contribution to the studies about ISIS, Ömer?
So basically, I was. This is a book about military adaptation and innovation by an armed non-state actor, but a very extreme armed non-state actor. And what I was really trying to understand is how a widely hated, massively outnumbered, ludicrously outgunned organization managed to occupy over 120 cities, towns, and villages, from Marawi in southern Philippines all the way to Sabratha in western Libya. And it managed to, after controlling, it managed to fight and survive for years against overwhelming odds, including a coalition, an international coalition of over 77 states, mm-hmm. and four major intergovernmental organizations, tens of armed non-state actors. When I put the whole lot together, about 22 ISIS in the four countries engaged armed units from 22 armies, 22 state armies, and over 80 armed non-state actors, including coalition of state of militias like the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, Hezbollah, the Popular Mobilization Units, the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq, and so on and so forth. So how an organization that basically does not fit in the literature traditional explanations of how an insurgency could succeed and survive, doesn't have the popular support, doesn't have the external support, doesn't have the state sponsorship, doesn't even have a good strategy, or doesn't have a rugged geography to fight in, like the support of mountains or jungles, lacks all that, and it's an umbrella organization, and then pull one upset after that, one military upset after the other, mainly in urban warfare, and rises after a complete destruction, basically, almost complete destruction in 2010, rises from that, and in 4 years takes over the second largest city in Mosul in Iraq, as in the case of Mosul, and expands. And what I was arguing really very briefly is that it boils down to the tactical and operational level. And to demonstrate that, I was using a sample of about 17 urban battles. So you can say it's about 17 case studies in Iraq, in Syria. In Iraq, it was Mosul, Fallujah, and Ramadi. In Syria, it was mainly the governorate of Raqqa, including the city of Raqqa. It was Derna and Sirte. In Egypt, it was northeastern Sinai. So I was looking at all that and trying to make sense and argue that basically it's tactics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think you are not focusing on ideology of ISIS on your book. I know that, but do you think that is there any correlation between the ideology of ISIS and its war tactics in Syria, in Iraq, or Egypt?
Yes, there are correlations, but let me first explain like how what I meant by the categories of tactics. I was trying to say that there are about 15 categories of tactics that I explained them in detail in the book. And tactics is like a bigger let's say framing of techniques and procedures. Procedures here is used a bit flexibly because it's more like modus operandi, more ways to do things as opposed to procedures as we find them in institutions. And then a certain operational shift that was happening as well in these 17 urban battles. But back to the question of ideology, very briefly, I did not focus on ideology, except when it was militarily relevant. The ideology, in a way, legitimated the violence. Made it almost an ideological duty for the members of ISIS to fight, you know, with everything they got, including their lives. We saw in Mosul, you know, people on a disabled chair and still fighting, women with babies on their backs and still fighting. So, and then the suicide tactics, which was very very common. But the ideology did not just legitimate the weaponizing of almost everything, from booby trapping a pen all the way to booby trapping a 7-ton truck, but it also sort of made it a religious duty in a way. So there was the incentivization of fighting was very strong online. So that was categorized in one variable, the moral force, you know, like the will to fight. Clausewitz, to use a Clausewitzian term. The moral force, the host, you know, psychological variables and assets that makes the soldier or the fighter willing to fight. So that's on one. That's part of how the ideology was militarily relevant, but also the ideology in a way undermined the military effort mainly because of a few features and ramifications. Part of it the ideology was so extreme that it does not attract recruits except from very specific margins. So you limit your pool of recruits. It also, when you implement the ideology, you create lots of enemies because it's harsh. The implementation of the ideology was very harsh. Also, the ideology does not tolerate hair-thin differences. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the ISIS fought against organizations that were not very far from it, like Al-Qaeda. Ideological differences are very slim. This created, more puzzle for me really, because I was trying to understand. So how this organization survived that far while making enemies with almost everyone else, including organizations with hair thin differences. So that was the ideological, and also I talked a little bit about ideology in terms of where to put this organization. Is it what kind of ideological beast are we talking about? And I was arguing that this is primarily a Wahhabist jihadist organization in the way that we understand jihadism as a 20th century modern ideology that believes that the confrontation armed confrontation with its with the enemy is the most legitimate and the religiously legitimate and the most effective way to achieve political and social ends. And Wahhabist, in a way, that the inspiration of the organizations comes from the teachings of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, many of his teachings, so many of his writings. So in a way, I placed it in that ideological slim category within the largest spectrum of ideologies. And it uses takfirism a lot, like takfirist language a lot, like accusations of disbelief and so on. But I didn't categorize it as purely takfirist organization for specific reasons, and these were debates inside the organization. Not even so to some internal executions, you know, when people adopted, you know, purely takfirist stances. So I was looking, so this is the ideological dimension that I was looking, but the book was mainly about explaining the combat and the military effectiveness of an insurgent umbrella organization that really defies the traditional explanations that we have in the literature. And I went narrow and deep, you know, in a way. I narrowed it down to the military dimension and went as deep as I could to the town and even the neighborhood level.
So as part of this question, I would like to also ask about motivation as part of ideology. I mean the motivation. There are many foreign fighters within the ISIS structure, but I think the more motivation is important in applying different categories of war tactics. How do you think about motivation, war motivation, is important in different combat environment, different conflict landscape, and different actually enemy? You know, because ISIS fought against different type of enemies, I mean, so to speak, enemies in the eyes of ISIS. How do you think this motivation, is a mixed motivation, is so important in using these tactics?
It was, I think it was extremely important. But what I was arguing is that it was not unique. In a sense, the organizer, there were other forces fighting against it who were very motivated, willing to die as well. And we are talking about both state and non-state forces. So state, for example, rival organizations, jihadists or non-jihadists, were willing to fight it as hard as possible. Also, state forces, like, for example, the institution of the CTS in Iraq, the counterterrorism services, were very motivated to fight it for very different, for you know, they had very different reasons for that. But the organization was not the only, let's say, motivated group on the ground. The reasons it helped a lot in enhancing its fighting capabilities and in you know, in having suicide bombers, in shifting even battles, like I talked about the type of fighters that they had. And how they impacted the battle outcome. So in the case of the Battle of Mosul, one of the, you know, in 2014, ISIS was about to lose Mosul in 2014 in the attack. There was a counteroffensive, and it was it was a 6-day fight from 4th of June to the 10th of June, and on the third day it looked bad for ISIS. And then there was a change in the battle outcome, mainly because partly the resilience, their motivation to fight, but partly one of the suicide bombers who took, who destroyed the Mosul hotel with a Saudi suicide bomber, and took it down with a truck, which killed basically the heads of the some of the commanders of the Iraqi Federal Police, and that was the beginning of the change. You know, you kind of destroy the one of the headquarters, one of the important headquarters in the west of Mosul, and then the soldiers are left without command and started to panic. So So yes, it had an impact. It was not the only player that who is very motivated to fight in on the ground. Mm-hmm. But the reasons I was trying to argue, there was also very interesting features, but all of them I was trying to say that they were not very unique in terms of foreign fighter recruitment, in terms of how mm-hmm. the autonomization, like how ISIS was, the units were very independent. The transnational, transregional experiences in combat, you know, recruiting fighters from all over the world and soldiers from all over the world, actually. So all of that was there. It helped, but it was not the reason to have this extra edge that made it pull many of these upsets.
In your book, you mentioned that a mixture of conventional military tactics and guerrilla and terrorism strategies has paved the way for the success of ISIS expansion. What other factors should have been effective in combat success of ISIS, you think?
So, you know, one of the main factors is the resilience of the organization. You know, it was, remember in 2010, the predecessor of ISIS, ISI, the Islamic State in Iraq, was almost destroyed. Mm-hmm. I think it was Ray Odierno, the general, the commander, the U.S. commander in Iraq, who declared that 42 of the most senior of the organization's commanders, out of 42, there was about 36, if I remember correctly, were either killed or captured. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at an organization that is about to be destroyed in 2010. 4 years later, as I said, took over the second largest city in Iraq. They were kind of rising from the ashes. When they took Mosul, the minimum estimate was that they were fighting about 10 to 1. So for every ISIS fighter, there was at least 10 Iraqi soldiers. If you took the maximum estimates for this battle, the maximum manpower ratio, it would exceed 50 to 1. So basically, we're talking about a battalion-sized formation that attacked Mosul, and it was fighting against two divisions, the Federal Iraqi Police Division and Iraqi Army Division. So, and it was not one-off. That was repeated earlier in Fallujah. They were still outnumbered, but they managed to form a coalition of six other insurgent organizations and take it over in January 2014. And then in 2015, in May 2015, they took over Ramadi under the strikes of the coalition, and then you know in other parts of in Raqqa, in parts of Derna, in Sirte, and even in Sheikh Zayed for a brief period they took it, and then they were able to the army, the Egyptian army was able to take it back. So. These were all tactical to operational successes. There was no strategic success in the sense they could not hold any of these towns and cities. But the way they fought there was quite innovative. I tried to explain, to dissect the tactics and really the level of innovations there was relatively high. The level of operational art was also quite high. And I try to focus on the meso level, on the as on the organization level as a unit of analysis, showing what I called, as I mentioned, not so unique features of ISIS combat performance. It had some features that were very helpful in its combat performance, but they were not that unique. Moral force, unit cohesion, what I called autonomization, the independence of its very, very small units, you know, that they can operate without being part of a structure, without being so very modular in a sense. This trans-regional combat experience, flexible hierarchies, specialization focus, they are very focused on specialization in very, very detailed issues. And then this but all of this, I showed that other armed non-state actors had some of it, if not all of it. So they were not really the features that, you know, made the difference between them and others. So I went a bit deeper on what is more unique, which was mainly the innovations at a tactical level. about 15 categories of them. And then I go through them in detail. And then also analyze a bit of the operational level. So when ISIS enters a state, a new state, and most of its members and fighters are not from that state, what do they do then? When they operate at a town level or a city level, how do they operate? And then when they try to take over a town, sometimes unplanned, like the case of Mosul, it was not planned to take over the whole city, just parts of just certain neighborhoods. When that happens, how do they turn a raid into a raid, fortify, and then occupy a whole town? And then when they fight on the neighborhood level, on suburban and urban battles, what do they do then? So that was the level of details I was trying to get into in the book. And based on that, this is my finding really was like, you know, if you took this bunch of tactics with that level of operational art, then it explains how they pulled this up. And maybe this in the conclusion, but I was saying this is exportable. This is not unique to an ideology or an organization. This is just, like Sun Tzu's Art of War was exportable across millennia. Or more than a millennia, then this stuff is could be exportable, and this is the worrying point.
Mm-hmm. Many of us focused on ISIS operations and attacks in Syria and Iraq. We mainly focus on these two countries, but of course, in your book, you have also touched upon Egypt and Libya. What are the differences between these countries in terms of ISIS tactics?
Yes, there are some differences, significant ones. But first, most of the 15 categories, let's say, so most meaning more than 7 or 8, were pretty much employed in all 4 countries that I talked to and elsewhere. We saw some of them recently in places as far away as Mozambique, northern Mozambique. Mm-hmm. And what we can see in terms of differences between the 4 countries are, one, the quantity of the categories of tactics used, and two, the quality. So in Mosul, 2016-2017 specifically, you saw the top game. That was the elite game, you know, of ISIS units or IS units at that time. Then you saw a similar game in Raqqa. We saw also very high level in 2017. Then similar tactics and techniques, but of lower qualities and lesser quantities, were implemented in places like Sirte and Derna, and also in Sheikh. So that's in terms of the levels of quality and quantity. In terms of sometimes the documentations of the operations, there were relatively low documentations, if you wish, in places like I found that the units or the provinces of ISIS in Syria do not document as meticulous as the one in Egypt, for example, the Sinai province, which documents almost everything it does and publicize it in a way, part for propaganda, but also part to show that the counter propaganda of the Egyptian army is not very accurate. Mm-hmm. One of the comparisons I used in the book was that there was over 160 videos or photographic reports of suicide vehicle-borne IEDs issued during the Battle of Mosul, but less than 30 of these during the Battle of Raqqa in 2017. Mm-hmm. And there were definitely more than 30 suicide vehicle-borne IEDs operation in Raqqa. There was definitely more than that, but they just documented and showed 30 of them. So there is also a, in terms of strategic command on the tactical and operational level, it's a bit decentralized. So decentralized as on, let's say, neighborhood level, not just town level. Sometimes it's neighborhood level. And there's a difference clearly in resources in terms of the countries and regions. You know, with the, clearly, the most of the resources were concentrated in Iraq, and then lesser elsewhere.
Now, I think we can talk about three important periods in the short history of ISIS, of course, after the Arab Spring. So the first period is mainly about the pre-state, era in terms of, you know, growing number of ISIS fighters and the, you know, extensions of its territorial control over Syria and Iraq. And second era, of course, protestate or caliphatic era, if you like this word. And of course, end of the caliphate. So as far as I can remember, Stephen Wald described ISIS as a revolutionary state. So do you see any transformation in the short history of ISIS in terms of its war tactics? Because its proto-state, I think, structure provide it a very different strategic maneuver, and its territorial order also provided ISIS a different type of strategic flexibility against its adversaries. How do you think about this kind of transformation in a very, short time of history?
Definitely, that's a lot in one question, but definitely these strategic shifts were one of the reasons for its survival. Basically, the organization operates as follows. If it's losing resources and men and about to collapse, it stays within an urban terrorism strategy, meaning attacking soft targets, operating secretly, small groups, and it's very good at doing that. In 2010, there was like I think 2008, there was a specific decision from the so-called Minister of Defense back then, Abu Hamza Muhajir, was saying that that's it, we are disbanding sniper units, guerrilla formations, and focusing only on IED tactics. The specialization went as focusing on separating the units of manufacturing different parts of the IED. So it went that far. So it was a very clear shift in strategy with tactical and operational implications almost immediately. And then let's say we gained more resources, then we upgrade to a guerrilla strategy. So which is now, I think, in Iraq, for example, that's the status still, terrorism and guerrilla strategy. The guerrilla strategy has also some of the unique features, like one of it is the temporary control of territory. So don't take the territory or the town or the neighborhood or the village and hold it. Just take it for a while. Gather resources, eliminate informants, attack the police stations, take whatever funds, guns, resources useful for combat, and then withdraw after. Do your propaganda for recruitment, make sure that everybody sees this, and then disappear to avoid any losses. So that was and they published actually the modus operandi for this, how to do this, four articles in the Nebe. And then if you gather more resources, then you go for the conventional warfare dimension, or hold territory, declare a state, they declare a state regardless, even if they are small secret cells, they still declare, there's this obsession with statehood, if you wish. So that on one end. And then you shift when you lose territory, you upshift and you downshift. So if you territory, then you downshift to guerrilla. If you lose the guerrilla capacities, then you downshift to terrorism. And they were been functioning like that since the establishment of the Tawheed and Jihad, back in 2003, even earlier in 2002 when Zarqawi arrived in Iraq. So that's on one. And on what Walt was saying, it is true. I understood what he's saying yes, it is an organization that wants to implement sweeping very radical changes on a social and a political level, and wants to do this by force. So there is a revolutionary dimension. It's just it's just the wrong revolution. You know, it's just a revolution that will basically undo all the achievements that was that humanity gained from the probably mid 18th or 17th century all the way till now, including, you know, the freedom of expression, freedom from slavery, abolition of serfs, gender equality, you know, and so on and so forth. Like many of the gains that were made, ISIS wants to undo them. And in this area, yes, it can be the regressive revolution in many ways. But also in 2012, the Arab Spring, obviously I was one of the advocates of the Arab Spring, and in 2012, I was still hoping to see a fourth wave of democratization in the Middle East. So we've been through the third waves, and then hopefully the fourth wave of the democratization arrives, at least in the Arab region. It didn't, but also I was hoping to see a second wave of collective de-radicalization, which, you know, the first wave happened in the second half of the 20th century, and especially in the 90s and early 2000s. And then I was hoping to see a second wave of such de-radicalization, meaning, you know, abandoning violence as a tool for achieving political ends, and more or less keeping the keeping the competition and the rivalries and the animosities even within a constitutional framework, you know, for political parties, media campaigns, and so on, and get the weapons and the IEDs and the guns out of the of the power struggle competition. So I was hoping to see some of that, but then I saw in 2012 some of the tactics employed primarily by Jabhat al-Nusra back then in Aleppo, and the tactic employed basically made them take over a position, an urban position, well guarded, heavily fortified. After the FSA failed to take it more than 3 weeks, I think they took it in, they took the position basically in an attack that lasted about 10 minutes, maybe, using primarily suicide cars and guerrilla formations. And small suicide guerrilla formations, so in the Masayin and suicide car bombs. And when I saw this, I was like, okay, so if armed and state actors think that they can employ these tactics and have these quick victories, then we won't see a fourth wave of democratization and a second wave of de-radicalization, but we'll see like an evolution in combat in terms of military adaptation and innovation and more challenges to the state armed actors, because they will be challenged because there are, you know, a different game now on the ground. And I think in a way it was a pessimistic conclusion in the middle of the Arab Spring, but unfortunately this is what happened in a way.
Yes.
And this is actually what inspired me to write the book in the end. Like I wanted to understand how is this done.
Omar, I would like to focus on post-territorial era. Do you see any change of ISIS tactics or strategy about, you know, warfare, conflict in the post-territorial era, post-caliphatic era, after, you know, Mosul, Raqqa?
Basically, yes, in a way, what I mentioned, you know, the shift towards the I don't want to use the term conventional, but the shift towards guerrilla and terrorism, and avoiding the let's say the traditional conventional army, state army like ways of warfare, like using armored or using heavy artillery and so on, and then holding territory. This is clearly what the organization is right now. But also the organization did not give up the idea of statehood or caliphate or even holding territory, whether abandoning it temporarily, it's not happening. They do control neighborhoods and towns and villages for a while and then retreat or withdraw from it. But also even as we saw lately in Mozambique, that there is an attempt to take over a territory and control it by force. And it's useful for them in a way, partly for the propaganda, but also partly for gathering more and more resources, having populations and also the that that is a way to say to potential recruits, to the followers, that you know, it's not over. We still have capacities to control territory. Yes, not as before because of the, you know, the international coalition and so on, but we still have this capacity to go on. So yes, the main difference is the shift towards guerrilla and terrorism, with every now and then, you know, attempt over a over territorial control.
Mm-hmm. About its future, how do you see the future of ISIS? Is it possible to regrouping of ISIS in Iraq and Syria? Is it possible to talk about a new territorial era of ISIS territorial control in Iraq and Syria?
So I cannot make that prediction, but what I can ascertain is that the ways of warfare that the organization has used and showed will be employed by others. And we saw that already. So this is not new. We saw that already. And sometimes will be employed even by state actors. You know, some of it, some of these categories. So if you are able to employ such tactics and pull upsets, so what really destroyed the organization is that it had not had no viable grand strategy. It did not know what to do once it controls towns and cities, aside from continuing fighting. You know, so there was there was no end in its wars, basically. It did not show end. So it had no viable strategy. But it will keep on pulling off, you know, these upsets via tactical and operational methods. So these tactics and operations can be employed for with an organization that actually knows, that has a strategy, it has a grand strategy. And this is the worrying part. So I think this is what we will continue. Even if ISIS died as an organization, these tactics and techniques and modus operandi, or modi operandi, will continue. And in the, I can read you a small paragraph in from the concluding chapter, that IS kept on improvising, modifying, and upgrading with the weapon armor mobility triad under adverse conditions, even when its units were on the brink of a decisive defeat, such as in Derna in 2016 and in the tent city of Al-Baghouz in 2019. IS mounted captured artillery pieces on looted tank chassis, replaced cannons with anti-aircraft guns when it deemed necessary, up-armored infantry fighting vehicles, mounted BMP turrets on 4x4 vehicles, upgraded T-55 and T-62 tanks with locally manufactured armors. Some of them were even made of shell casings, converted flatbed trucks into weapon platforms. It combined commercial drones. Its combat units used commercial drones to deliver IEDs and to guide SVBITs, so suicide vehicle-borne IEDs, utilized SVBITs as precision bombs and guided rocket barrages, converted 7-ton large SVBITs into cruise-like missiles, human-guided land torpedoes, and executed marine-like infantry breaching sequence combined with suicide vehicle-borne IEDs. They employed commercial GPS applications on civilian smart gadgets to enhance the accuracy of their mortar shots, teleoperated sniper rifles to offset the snipers from the weapon for protection, outflanked tanks with swarming anti-tank kill tanks, and pioneered in the execution of several suicide guerrilla formation tactics in both urban terrorism and conventional battle, among numerous tens of other technical and tactical level innovations. So if you take this, these categories of tactics, basically, that I organized in about 15 of them, it has nothing to do with ideology and nothing to do with, you know, which organization are we talking about. It's all exportable. Yes. And this is obviously a real challenge to state armies on one end. But also it tells you that, you know, if the weaker side, if the other side, if the non-state side think they can win, then we'll see more continuity of this as opposed to an end to it. And that's my pessimistic note.
Okay, so I have two questions, final questions. I don't like to talk about the numbers, but do we have any number about the ban loss of ISIS in all these combats?
It's all estimates. There are high end and low end estimates, but some of the estimates reach like 50,000, over 50,000. At one point in 2017, the organization was losing, the losses were basically on daily basis, like I think 45 killed per day for about year. So it was losing a lot, one estimate was it was about 45,000, but this is back in 2017, you know. So again, like 45, it's like, you know, some state armies cannot take these losses, you know, like quite a few state armies actually cannot take these losses. If you want to put it in perspective, look at the amount of the US the deaths in Afghanistan recently and the recent withdrawal. Israel withdrew from South Lebanon in 1985 to South after 300 deaths.
Of course, you are not focusing on countering ISIS in the context of CT strategies and tactics, but what is the list for lessons learned for the states in the region?
I was trying to stay as far as possible from the counterterrorism manual counterinsurgency critique for so many reasons. Part of it is there are like some excellent counterterrorism manuals out there. Also, the counterinsurgency, I saw the amount of suffering that many of these counterinsurgents have endured while fighting ISIS. Well, one example, the CTS, all the battalion commanders of the CTS, all 14 of them, were killed in the Battle of Mosul, during the Battle of Mosul. So it was very difficult for me to come and tell them, you know, this is what you're doing wrong. So what I wanted to just say in that book is basically, okay, this is an organization and this is how it fights and this is how it pulled upsets and this is what I was trying to explain. There are implications clearly for that, like, you know, we can dissect it or can maybe write another book, how to fight ISIS, you know. But it's just each of these categories of tactics have counter tactics and I describe some of them. Because you know, you are evolving. It's like a strategic diet, if you wish. The reasons it pulled many of these upsets because it was a shock. Many of the armed state actors were very surprised by these tactics. They did not know how to fight back, both state and non-state action. And then gradually, some of these shocks were absorbed. Some of these tactics were countered, and so on. It's not over, but there is progress. So there are policy implications, both strategic, operational, and tactical. But I did not intend this to be, it is more like how ISIS fights, as the title says, as opposed to how to fight ISIS, in a way.
Yes. Omar, thank you so much, and congratulations again about your newly published book, and thank you for your contribution to this timely event and panel. Thank you, Omar.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to be with you, Murat, and participating in CETA's event. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'm closing the panel, and thank you for listening us today, and hope to see you. Our next panel, our second book talk for next week.